expand or extend so-called natural faculties, and that most so-called supernatural powers are natural powers which we do not understand, and that gradually these natural powers, because they are natural, will have their normal and proper growth and development, and each one will usher us into a kind of world suitable to itself, and give us a participation in value or problem beyond what we know at the present time. The principal problems that we face today on the so-called extrasensory level have therefore been taken up by a group like Dr. Rhine and his associates at Duke, and they have advanced almost a common answer to everything. Now, we're always a little afraid of these pat answers. When we have one answer for everything, we begin to pause for a moment and remember that we have not yet cured the common head cold. There is no proof that any solution is a total answer. But along comes the Duke group with the concept that what we might term a kind of telepathy is actually the solution to practically every form of so-called extrasensory perception. That mental transference explains psychism, explains mediumship, explains clairvoyance, and that practically every problem that appears to imply an extrasensory situation can be solved on the basis that man does possess a faculty of picking out of the minds of other persons certain leading thoughts or ideas. So we have thought transference, which 100 years ago was considered itself a form of magic. Today it is beginning to take on the respectable appearance of a probability. We are now gravely suspicious, particularly as the result of development in radio and television, that it is quite conceivable that man does possess a receiving set within himself which can react to energies moving from the mental and emotional fields of other persons. That it is, therefore, quite possible for us to pick things out of other people's minds. It is also true in most cases that we do not know that we are doing this, that the process is not yet voluntary, that we may not even know whose minds we are picking these things out of, nor are we in any way certain that they have to be contemporary minds. We live in a world of minds. We know that it is perfectly possible to go to the archives of a motion picture studio, get out a film that was made 20 years ago, and run it again. We also know perfectly well that vibration never ceases. Therefore, although it is forever changing, never diffusing, it never ends once it is set in motion. Scientists not so long ago were really seriously contemplating the possibility of creating a device sensitive enough to pick out of space Lincoln's Gettysburg Address in the original. That it is conceivable that it can be done. It will be in a wonderful, strange, and a little morbid day when it comes to pass that everything that we have said or will say in the near future could be picked out of space by somebody 100 years from now, especially some of those rather quiet talks in the back room. Family arguments, name calling, and also those various legislative procedures behind closed doors might make wonderful material for mental reviving at some future time. Probably would result in the total rewriting of history and the complete collapse of our psychology of historical orientation, which might be a good thing. Now, if it is possible that a mind can pick out of other minds or other times or out of the mental life of the total collective folk or body of mankind certain thoughts, then it might be also fair to say that everything else being equal, those thoughts in the collective mind most strongly held would be most quickly available to other minds, because the body of such thinking, more intense, with more continuity, would be a more powerful vibratory wave likely to break through into the consciousness of a sensitive person more rapidly than perhaps some gentle and very furtive ray that it has little, if any, support down through time. That we may live in a world in which some of our thinking is derived from other minds, perhaps much of it, opens an interesting field of speculation. First it was heredity, then it was mental telepathy, which was advanced to answer the question of why we behave like human beings. Is it possible, therefore, that all our thinking is affected by waves of mental energy around us? That perhaps everywhere, all the time, we are being bombarded by thoughts? Obviously, there has to be some control of this, or else we would be drowned in a world of collective thoughts, notions, and attitudes. We are not. Some method of integration, of filtering, of control, and direction is present in our own natures, so that apparently we do our own thinking. But under certain conditions, pressures seem to arise in our thinking, which we cannot account for, and which then perhaps may be regarded as arising from collective thought or from the mental life of the world around us. This is an intriguing procedure to develop. It also suggests a universal availability of common thought material. The only possible answer to the problem at the moment is that the faculty for the receiving and interpreting into objective awareness of these collective pressures is very slightly present in the majority of persons. But in some individuals, in a small number of individuals, it is rather more present, but in very few indeed to any degree of exceptional markedness. Thus, a truly consistent mind reader or telepathist who can perform any useful or notable achievement in such a field is extremely rare, and when such a person appears, becomes a wonder of his generation. Yet that such a person can appear, there seems to be no doubt. Therefore, he is either a freak, an anomaly of some kind, or else he bears witness to a law. And as we are inclined to believe that there are no accidents and no real freaks, and that all things pertain to law, there must be an explanation for such a person. This explanation may force us to accept, ultimately, that such a faculty is latent in every human being. The next point that goes beyond this situation relates to the application of this so-called telepathic faculty in the ability of the individual to capture some lost or forgotten factor in the life of an individual. Let's take a simple case and see if we can make anything of it. An individual goes to a sensitive or a mystic or a psychic, saying that at some past time a valuable document was lost. Where was this document placed? The psychic, in a short time, is able to come up with an answer as to where the document is. experience and experimentation indicate that this would be a remarkable occurrence. Yet, the proof lies in the fact that the document was in the place so described and was promptly rescued. Now, such things have happened. In fact, there is a person in the United States at the present time whose specialty is to help the police to solve crimes. They have come to a very marked degree of success with cases completely baffling the police, in which no known element of help could be found. Thus, such a thing is possible. Now the question arises, who knew where that document was originally placed? How did it get into the place where it was found without the individual who sought for it knowing where it was? The next question is, did this person ever know where it was? That is a very difficult question. Under hypnotic regression, it has been found, on some occasions at least, that the lost article was actually placed where it was found by the person later unable to remember where it was. And therefore, that in the subconscious of this person, the true location of the article was always known. In the subconscious of this person, the true location of the article might be known in other ways. For instance, supposing this article had been placed where it was found by a parent, friend, or relative of the individual searching for it, and done during the childhood or infancy of the person who later sought it. If in their presence, 40 or 50 years ago, when they may not have been over 6 weeks old, the person who placed the article stated in their presence to someone else where the article was, it could always be refound from the subconscious of that younger individual. So who knows all the details of this particular situation? If the article was placed, someone knew where it was. Did that someone tell anyone else? Is that someone dead? Before they died, did they communicate it to anyone else who might be keeping that secret, if so, it could still be picked out of somebody's mind? So the problem of the mind as its relationship to these situations is extremely tricky. Now there is another problem that is almost equal to this, and that is that we possess another faculty which must sometime be recognized. And that faculty is our ability to sensitively pick up atmospheric impression. This is generally called psychometry, or the ability to recover impressions from objects, articles, or places. Such faculty does exist, although also very rare. It is perfectly possible to place a glass of water in a room, that 100 people walk through that room within 24 hours. A psychometrist sufficiently gifted can then take the glass of water and describe every person. But there are very few that possess this gift. Yet it exists. Therefore, it is possible to pick up all kinds of information from inanimate subjects in which impressions of energy have been placed. In other words, is mental energy the only kind that can be received? Or can sensory energy also be picked up by an extrasensory band of faculty perception? Can sounds made in the past be heard again through a retentive power of our ability to hear? So through all of the sensory faculties. This is, again, a good question. We do not know the answer completely, but we do know that during World War II, a certain person received a letter from a very close relative in a German concentration camp. It was a little note, very little to it, sent through the Red Cross, which permitted only the signature of the person and that he might X two or three statements such as, I am well, or I am not well, trouble, or I am in need of something which the Red Cross might permit to be sent through. Very little could be placed upon this piece of paper because it was a concentration camp note. This note was received by the nearest of kin of the individual in the concentration camp. This nearest of kin, believing their relative to be dead, was overjoyed to find out that the person was still alive. And in their almost completely subjective delight over the matter, took the note to bed, this little card-like note, and went to sleep holding this in their hand. In the middle of the night, they awakened with a tremendous experience of visualization. They saw the concentration camp. They saw that friend or relative. They saw the kind of a place he lived in. They saw the number of windows, the shape of the doors, every part of this building, and several other persons close to the individual. A careful note was made, and by an intuitive procedure, though now awake, the person holding the note made a sketch of the detail of the concentration camp they had seen. Later, this was compared with an actual photograph of the camp after the war was over and agreed in every detail. And apparently the only contact was this note and the intensity of the individual. Thus, we may assume that something which Paracelsus called an effluvia, or energy, containing something susceptible of impression, was certainly communicated. There are many cases in which primitive medicine priests, witch doctors, voodoo doctors, have been able to take photographs of persons. And taking 10 photographs of unknown persons and spreading those photographs out in front of them, move their hands over the surface of the photograph and call out each one who was already dead. Because they said that the photograph itself carried some kind of a vibratory relationship to the person. Most primitive people will not allow a likeness of themselves to be made because they fear sorcery. These things we do not believe in general, but we do not explain them. And research such as has been carried on in a few groups in this country and in Europe would seem to indicate that there is every reason to suspect that there are energy fields which can be contacted. Also, that there are persons called sensitive who are born with a somewhat more acute development of certain faculties, often accompanied by an inferior development of some other faculties, who are able to become more conscious or more aware of this extrasensory gamut than the average individual. But that this does not mean either magic or sorcery, or the presence of some extraordinary mystical attribute. It is simply that we live in a world of dimensions and powers and faculties and propensities, most of which are unknown to us. And we have been so busy trying to prove there were no more than what we know, that we have gradually worked ourselves into a situation in which our natural growth is beginning to reveal energies and powers for which we have no explanation, because we have not attempted to create rational explanation for these things. Now, it would not be fair to go on in this direction without pointing our entire thinking to certain other values, which are certainly close to our consideration. From the scientific and the psychological and the study of the extrasensory field, as it is now being explored by a few progressive scientists, we must go on to our philosophical and religious fields, where to a large measure our deepest concerns would naturally be. does man possess these faculties of true knowing, by means of which it is possible for him to rise from the level of sense and opinion and approach a state of clear insight, or clear voyance, or clear seeing, by means of which error can be overcome in his own contemplation of life? Is it possible for man to have the direct experience of God? Is the mystical experience a bona fide spiritual experience, or is it a psychological experience? Is it possible that man can develop and intensify faculties of inner living and inner thinking by means of which he can become aware of a spiritual world beyond the one in which he now exists? Is this a kind of positive overtone of spiritualism? Whereas spiritualism consists of communications, at least so assumed, between the living and the dead, is this other thing man's ability to experience a living participation in a world beyond the one in which he now lives? I believe that the first approach to this lies in the records of antiquity. And to a measure at least, these records are negative from the standpoint of true spiritual experience. We know that ancient people did create a condition of temporary clairvoyance by hypnosis and drugs. We know that they were able to cause persons to have the experience of leaving this kind of world that we know and coming into another kind of world, entirely apart from anything that we commonly experience today. Was this world genuine, or is it merely a kind of dream world in which the individual, subjectively retiring into his own consciousness, there experiences a universality which he cannot explain or interpret in terms of his ordinary sensory perception? It would seem that such can happen. Whether this is the total answer must be given further thought. But that man can appear to have a separate life in a dream state, that he is capable of a kind of inner living in which he is not aware of dreams, but seems to exist in another kind of world, but that this world is subjectively within himself, we may affirm to be a possible experience. Is there another possible experience in which he proceeds into a true world beyond the one which he knows at the present time? The empiric answer to such a question is rather obvious, namely that there is no possible reason to question why man could not have a larger experience. To deny a larger experience is to empirically deny the possibility that there are things around us and with us at all times which are not within the range of our sensory perception. It is almost certain from our modern scientific knowledge that we are isolated into a very small part of a living universe, that the larger part of this universe is simply beyond our sensory experience, but has a perfectly valid existence. Anything, therefore, which would cause a sudden and dramatic repolarizing of our sensory experience, or make available to us faculties or perceptions not now generally available, could well launch us into an entirely different kind of world. That this kind of world might be in some way reminiscent of the kind of world that has been observed by mystics in their dreams and visions is not impossible. For it is quite possible that these dreams and visions actually represent attunement to a sphere beyond our common experience. Thus there could well be a universe of races and types of life and degrees of advancement and achievements and attainment that we simply do not know anything about. It is also possible as has been pointed out, that under certain peculiar situations, the individual might have a temporary glimpse of such a larger universe. There are several records in classical writing, such as the vision of Scipio and others, of persons brought close to death or believed to be dead or in a state of suspended animation so complete that no pulse was to be found in the body at all. Yet this person did revive after having been pronounced dead. Under such conditions, these persons frequently report experiences which occur. And it is interesting to note that usually these reports are similar, if not identical. Therefore, it is quite possible that they bear witness to a dimension of faculty perception made available to us by the separation of consciousness from body. Therefore, that the obscuration of consciousness or faculty by body is one of the reasons why the gamut of our senses is so limited. That it is the bodily structure through which the senses operate that restricts them to the narrow field which we recognize. Therefore, that the separation of consciousness from body may also release faculties from material restriction and permit a larger area of faculty receptivity. That consciousness may well survive death is now a greatly considered point. And whereas in the past this was held to be purely religious, it is now held to be quite possibly scientific by a number of our more prominent thinkers. Thus, we are moving toward a little different attitude on the whole problem of our spiritual life. Almost all systems of religion and philosophy have used certain disciplines in order to refine the lives of disciples and initiates for the attainment of the internal experience of the presence of God or truth. Most religious groups are able to produce examples of individuals who were so illumined and in whose lives marked and marvelous changes took place which cannot be normally accounted for on the level of ordinary conduct. Thus, Christianity has its St. Francis of Assisi. It has its St. Buenaventura. It has its mystics. It has its prophets. So have the ancient testament. So have other people of every part of the world. And these mystics all maintain the validity of an inner kind of vision and declare that by means of this vision, the uncertainties and non-tranquilities of material life were removed, and that a new assurance, a new security, and an irresistible impulse to virtue. All these were bestowed by a dynamic experience of personal consciousness. What this personal experience is, this mystical experience of Havelock Ellis, perhaps we may not be in a complete position to say. But one thing we are reasonably certain, that it is either the nearest to reality that man can achieve, or else it is the most glorious of all illusions, an illusion which transforms life from mediocrity to magnificence, and as such is itself worthy of cultivation. For we can judge all things only by their consequences, and we are inclined to cultivate or encourage that the consequences of which are in every way meritorious, producing a better level of living, a greater dedication to principles, a greater love for fellow man, and a greater veneration for the principles of life and truth and virtue. Thus, regardless of our approach, we have the common opinion of all men in the reverence of many and in the actual experience of a few, that there is a group of powers, faculties, or energies resident in man by means of which he is able to actually transcend his own humanity, arriving or ascending to a place in which is superior to that commonly inhabited by his reason and his emotions, where he is capable of a transcendent concept and experience of life. How then might we say that such a situation could be produced? We can go back to our original premise, namely that in all probabilities our sensory perceptions are limited by the bodily vibratory rate, by means of which our external personality, having attained to a certain degree of organic development, becomes the blinder or restrictor of our vision, holding our sensory reflexes to a certain level and giving us only a gamut within which we can function. All of our philosophies are agreed upon one point, namely that the refinement of man's own organic nature, the gradual sublimation of his intensity, his psychological, spiritual, intellectual maturity, maturity in this case being released from unreasonable pressure and intensity, freedom from ignorance, release from superstition, a complete overcoming of fear, and the gradual integration of life in a strangely calm, orderly pattern of conduct. In other words, the removal of pressure, that the individual in a completely relaxed condition is in this condition most likely and most able to penetrate through the pressures which normally restrict, limit, and even hypnotize his sensory perception. Buddha takes the position very firmly that what we would term man's apperception of divine things is prevented solely by his dedication and his psychological allegiance to human things. Therefore, that as long as man's mental energy is defending his humanity, it will continue to obscure his divinity. If, however, man releases himself from his ego pressure, releases himself from all of the circumstances by which he binds his consciousness totally to his own objective life, then and then only is he able to allow consciousness to flow naturally, or to reveal naturally its own universality. Most of our greater mystics have assumed that man possesses a spiritual organ of perception, that this spiritual organ of perception perceives or accepts into itself a spiritual experience and is capable not only by sight alone, but by a magnificent compound of senses, an apperceptive total experience, that it is capable, therefore, of accepting the total impact of total life within its own structure. That this faculty is a kind of synthetic faculty, that it is composed of the five faculties that we know plus two we do not know, and that these together, forming a septenary, constitute man's capacity to accept into himself the pure impulse of life or God. That this impulse of life or God, having been accepted into his nature, is immediately conditioned by his personality, and when brought through into his objective awareness, will always be clothed completely in his own expectancies. If he believes a certain thing, his experience of truth will be in the terms of that thing. And for this reason, any individual who has an experience cannot be convinced by another person who has had a contrary experience that both can be right. Each person assumes that his own experience must be the true and valid experience for all men. He does not realize that the way in which light comes to him is determined by his own capacity to accept light and by the specializations which exist within his own preconceptions. Consequently, as your Eastern mystic points out, always these mystical experiences take symbolic form, except in the case of the individual who has completely transcended the symbolic process in himself. The individual who has achieved the complete suspension of ego, so that he expects nothing, requires nothing, demands no form, shape, condition, or kind of experience, and does not have to interpret this experience in any ordinary familiar symbolism. Only such a person is capable of a pure experience, and this is extremely rare. The formless acceptance of God, the acceptance of deity totally, a complete possession by God, without qualification, condition, or modification, in which this God has no appearance, no humanity, is bound to no gospel and no creed, quotes no scripture, but is simply present as a total life, indicates the emancipation of the individual from any and all conditioning attributes. The purpose of your old mystery instruction was always to reduce these conditionings so that the individual could come closer and closer to this pure experience, which is the pure validity of experience. Wherever this pure experience comes, it is formless, pictureless, and comes as a complete clairsentience, a complete awareness without any center of awareness, a simple overflowing of life into that person, life, consciousness, and being moving in upon this individual from every direction, carrying with it only the total effulgency of its own significance and its own sufficiency, no condition of any kind. Such an experience naturally cannot be communicated to anyone else. It cannot be adequately formulated mentally, and any effort to reason upon it, to think about it, to pass judgment on it, annihilates it. It cannot be named, nor can it be analyzed. It must be merely and completely accepted as it is, as a total experience, totally apart from any limited or personal adjustment that we might have. Our philosophies and religions affirm that such an experience is possible. We have no scientific data to the effect that it is not possible. The only answer lies in the fact that it represents a level of cognition as yet not available to the majority of persons, but not an unreasonable extension of another kind of cognition which we all experience constantly, and also for which we have no name. And that is the experience of sudden comprehension. We are studying something. Let us take, for example, for this purpose, the study of language. Give us a good example of the point. We're going to study a foreign language. We're going to study German. English is our tongue. So we start and we learn the German pronunciation of the letters. We begin to study the structure of German verbs. We begin to ponderously attempt to pronounce certain mysterious, dotted German tones, which are to the non-German quite confusing. We begin also to adjust ourselves to the fact that gender is a strange animal in German, and that we never know when we look at a table, or a chair, or the ceiling, or a book, whether it's male, female, or neutral. These things are very confusing. So we proceed to try to learn German, thinking English. We try to think English into German, and German into English. And we go along like this, lame in our meaning and our method. But we do stay with it, with everything that we have. And suddenly, without warning, suddenly we seem to move on the opposite side of the fence. Suddenly we awaken one morning and discover that we have learned how to think German. From that moment on, the language just goes along beautifully. And we have the language. We have it the moment something happens, which is a kind of little illumination inside of ourselves, a new orientation. And up to that point, we're in trouble every minute. From that point on, the trouble ceases, and it is only a matter of increasing vocabulary and gaining increasing familiarity. We have mastered some mysterious thing inside of ourselves. Now, the same thing happens constantly in living. There is a kind of comprehension, the kind of comprehension that suddenly makes a man who has a lot of tools into a carpenter. Something happens. Or the individual who has a lumber of brushes and some canvases, suddenly, after a certain amount of discipline, a certain amount of integration, suddenly feels himself an artist. Until that happens, he cannot accomplish a great deal. This has to come. And it comes through certain awareness, certain experience, certain patience, certain familiarity and repetition, until this thing happens. Well, this is the principle about which most of your great religious systems have developed their concept of illumination. It is that in a certain situation, after a certain effort, a certain consecration, a certain dedication over a period of time, there is a sudden burst of light from within the consciousness. It suddenly knows or grasps these factors with which it has previously labored as a thing separate from itself. When it accepts them into itself, you have this mysterious thing. It has accepted them into itself. It has intuited them. It has come to know them as an experience by what we call intuition. So there is that moment in which we suddenly find that all the labor of the past is bearing its fruit. And until that time, it looked very sterile and difficult. The same way in disciplines of philosophy, mysticism, and religion. There are long roads in which nothing seems to happen. We go along hoping to know, struggling to find out, seeking to believe, desperately desirous of being convinced of something bigger or better. Suddenly, something happens. And all this labor, this effort, becomes ensouled, dynamically, vibrantly possessed by something. And in that moment, all the doubts and uncertainties seem to fade away, and we are in possession of. We have gained a facility in. We know certain facts about this thing with which we have been laboring. And so we, the ancients, have this idea of a kind of cognition. A cognition that results from the patient application of principles and the gradual refinement of structure, the unfoldment of capacity, the devotion of life to the service of its own primary need, this need for life. And then suddenly, all these things in their own good time bearing their own proper fruit, the arriving or arising of this situation that seems to be the solution, the answer, the natural product of all this effort, striving and trying that has previously come to us. In this, then, the ancients believed man has this power, the power which lies behind the senses. After all, what is the power that animates sensory perception? It is energy. Man has five senses that he knows of and two that are as yet not completely individual. Literally, the seventh sense, which is sense in suspension, the Sabbath of the senses, the resting or the peace of the senses, contains all of them. And this seventh sensory power, which is the chemical substance of all the others, is the faculty or sensory power of pure conception, or pure knowing, pure apperceiving. When the faculties separately continue their way, man lives in a universe of fragments. When two or more of them unite, these fragments begin to make order. When five of them unite, we have civilization, for whatever it is worth. When seven of them unite, we have consciousness, a factual situation brought into objectivity by the union of divided parts. For only by their union, and by the new faculty released by their union, is man capable of total cognition. Therefore, scientifically, if you wish to assume it, what we would call cosmic consciousness is merely the inevitable extension of ordinary consciousness. There is nothing mysterious about it. It is the destiny and end of all consciousness, that it shall be universal. And it is the destiny of all creatures that they shall grow and unfold until they are capable of becoming the conscious instruments of this consciousness. But at various times along the way, as we all observe, there are what we would term anomalies. There are persons who are born apparently out of time, often before their time. There are persons who lived 2,000 years ago, whose vision is greater than ours today. There are leaders, philosophers, and mystics of the past, whose understanding we have not yet equaled. Thus also in our daily lives, there are those around us who have different degrees of the inevitable development of these sensory conscious factors. And occasionally, out of these patterns, there comes an exceptional example. These exceptional examples are more frequent than we realize. But we do not recognize them because we are not trained to know what constitutes an extra faculty power. Actually, almost everything that we call genius represents an intensification of faculty. A great musician, a great artist, a great sculptor. These persons represent levels of consciousness development beyond that of the ordinary. If it were not true, we could all do what they do, and we cannot. We cannot all be a Leonardo da Vinci. But he is simply an example of a development of faculties and an arrangement of them, by means of which greater resources are available to him because there is less confusion and conflict among the sensory faculties and less obscuration of these faculties by the density of ignorance and matter. These persons have earned their abilities, and they have sharpened the instruments by constant use. We are not sharpening our instruments as rapidly as they did, therefore we do not possess them. But actually, consciousness is in many ways. John Sebastian Bach had a great consciousness for music. This consciousness was just as truly a mystical thing as were the revelations of Emanuel Swedenborg or Andrew Jackson Davis. There is just as much mystery and wonder in the magnificent attainments of great musicians, artists, creative geniuses, and even great creative scientists as there are in the so-called fabled Mahatmas of Asia. All of these represent degrees of consciousness faculty development. And we have around us constant examples of these attainments. If these attainments move particularly and directly into philosophy and religion, then we think of these persons as prophets, sages, saviors, world teachers, and regard them as essentially different from attainment in other fields. Actually, all consciousness growth represents the gradual attainment of a superior state of internal cognition, a hyper-awareness of values, factors, powers, forces, energies, substances necessary for the expression of creativity. And when we are able to tune into these things, we are able to produce the outstanding works which these persons produced. They did not know how they did it. They did not realize what was happening, but many of them were extremely devout and did sense that this power that was in them was not merely their own, but was the power of a divine principle moving within them. This type of dedication is the recognition that all great works are the works of the one great worker, that worker being the divine power in man. Adjustment to this power is, therefore, a natural degree of consciousness. And that such consciousness is possible, we have every reason to assume. That all that passes for it is not this, we also know. But we further realize that the proof of these things is in terms of their works. True consciousness produces works which are natural to itself and reveal their integrity and their security through all time to come. False consciousness is usually associated with pretensions not sustained by works and may therefore be rather easily discriminated by those who have the faculty to know. An individual, without becoming especially better or more noble, may sharpen certain faculties, may even develop an extrasensory band such as that of telepathy. But the individual who desires to have a strange but profound spiritual at-one-ment with the divine root of things must walk in the way of heaven, must follow the dictates of truth and of spirit, and obey the laws of that God, by means of which these good things are to come to him. Failure to do this is to frustrate the purpose. Therefore, we may say that man may build faculties, or he may build integrities. And somewhere along the line, he may build both. Faculties plus integrities constitute true growth. Faculties without integrities mean very little. Therefore, the problem is always that the growth of consciousness comes through the actual growth of the being, the total growth of its resources, its dedication, and conscious devotion to principles. This does not necessarily mean also that these things are accomplished at present, for there is much to point out that previous activity through the law of rebirth and karma may bring to the individual in this lifetime something which he cannot perceive to be directly associated with his present actions. Therefore, he may appear to be enjoying privileges that he has not earned or being denied values which he feels are justly his own. All doubts and uncertainties of this nature must themselves be suspended, or they will destroy the spiritual achievement that is sought. The individual must accept a lawful universe, earn what is not yet available, and use what is available with the deepest wisdom and understanding that he possesses. Other courses of procedure are dangerous. But out of it all comes this realization that what we call the larger consciousness of man is an involved process of extending known values toward their infinites or toward their ultimate development and growth, and of combining with these comparatively unknown factors, all of which combine together to fulfill the ancient admonition, "Be ye perfect." And in order to attain such a state of perfection, the consciousness of man must increase and extend beyond its present attainment. Well, I think that's all we can do for this time, so we hope to see you again in the near future. Thank you.